knife.
I hate it when you don't fade. What's that about? No, no, don't do it now. It's fine. Okay. Thank you.
Linoleum knife.
You're Dave White.
Blaine's not a name, it's an appliance.
Duh.
I don't want you to see where I live. That's the line that resonated most in that movie for me.
Did it?
Yeah, because that was the thing I always thought about anytime anyone ever considered coming over to my house when I was a kid.
Oh, now you're going to depress me. Everyone else finds your forlorn childhood stories hilarious, and they just make me sad.
Yeah, but I tell them in such a jaunty way.
No, that, I know. I mean, obviously, you survived and everything, and came out okay on the other end of it, but I just feel
you know
bad.
What the thing was really mostly, though? It wasn't that I was always ashamed of the places we lived in, although I was, for the most part. I was mostly...
Of the people who lived there?
Mostly, I was ashamed of... the way our homes always smelled like saloons, basically. Like, there was always the smell. It smelled like a bar in my house when I was a kid. Like, and I'm sure that I smelled like a bar when I was a kid and didn't realize it.
Right.
You know, like, everything
just
was
by osmosis.
Stale alcohol and cigarette smoke. You know, that's, those are smells I know very well. That movie we're talking about, the movie we're talking about is Pretty in Pink.
Yes.
Which is where that,
cover,
that song comes from, that you have chosen for, I don't know what.
I just like that. I've always liked that song.
Yeah.
Like that version, in fact.
It's from the Pretty in Pink
soundtrack.
Cassette soundtrack that we had. And,
because I heard that version first, and then I went back and heard the Nick Kershaw original. And frankly, I think the phrasing on this song is better. I like this version better.
It is. This version is much more produced and accessible to young 80s kids, which is what you were. The
Pretty in Pink, actually.
She says, at one point, she says to Richie, Rich Dude,
Blaine.
Andrew McCarthy, yeah. Blaine. She's like, I don't want you to see where I live. Because she's poor.
Right.
But edgy and cool.
Shops vintage. You know, Pretty in Pink is actually...
Makes her own ugly progress.
Oh, God.
Look what I did. Look, it's like she shows up at the end of the movie in this thing that looks like a fourth grader cut it out of felt squares. And she's like, I made myself a progress. And everyone's like, oh, you're such a genius.
I think even Molly Ringwald's like, yeah, that dress.
Yeah.
Pretty in Pink was the reason behind the first time I ever came to Los Angeles.
Oh, because you were in college and you did the Pretty in Pink press.
Junket.
The Pretty in Pink press junket.
I did. Yeah. Yes.
What happened at the Pretty in Pink press junket? Before we start talking about the movies this week, tell me about that.
Well, let's see. They put us up at Le Mondrian. It was very fancy. And so, because I was in college and I had this whole hotel room to myself, I invited my friends Kurt and Rosalinda to come out too. So they flew themselves to LA on their own dime and, you know, we all crashed in this room.
We're going
to
party.
Yeah, pretty much.
And, James Spader.
Yeah, well, no, not so much. We did abuse the Paramount room service, but
who cares?
I
we
know.
Can afford it.
But it was, you know, so it was all these college students around the country, and they just sort of herded us into all these. It wasn't even like round tables; they were literally more like press conferences, you know. So it was kind of like there.
What do you mean?
Well, round tables usually there's like you and eight,
a dozen other.
Yeah, maybe a dozen. You know, around a big table. But there was like there was 25 of us, I'd say. And so we would all herd into these, like, you know, ballrooms or whatever,
like
meeting rooms at the Le
Mondrian. Rows.
Yeah, know? Yeah, right. Essentially.
So and like then, a White House press conference.
Exactly, right. Yeah. And then there'd be the table up front.
Only with Molly Ringwald instead of the president.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Which is way better.
Pretty much, given the choice,
like if
yeah.
You, yeah, if you're going to go to a press conference, who do you want? I mean, Obama's great. I'm pro our president. Yes. Most of the time, yeah. And given the alternatives, yes.
And he would probably choose, I don't know. Who,
I think he would probably choose Molly Ringwald over himself, too.
Well, I'm just wondering.
Who wouldn't?
Would Obama or Molly Ringwald pick better Supreme Court justices, is my question.
Molly Ringwald would pick better Supreme Court. Absolutely, Molly Ringwald would compete, would pick better Supreme Court justices. Mm. Because she's, I've read plenty of interviews with her.
Yeah.
She's no smart. Dummy.
Yeah, yeah, she is.
And, And
like Mitt Romney, speaks very good French.
Pragmatic, speaks French perfectly. Yeah. And, yeah, she speaks French well enough to be in a Godard movie. So,
well, that movie's in English, but she speaks French.
She was?
Yes, but she's...
I don't remember
have
that.
Have you not seen King Lear?
I thought I had.
It's in English.
Am I a dummy?
Well, I'm not going to answer that right now, but...
We have a VHS copy of that movie. Didn't we watch it together?
I don't know.
I think it was in French?
It's in English.
Excuse me.
But she speaks good enough.
Question. Here's the answer to any question of which there is no immediate answer. I'm an idiot. Let's move on.
Well, I'm glad you said that. Anyway, she does speak good enough French to have been in French films that were not directed by Godard, though.
Yeah, she did do that too.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know. Yeah. But yeah, so it was great. So we interviewed Molly Ringwald. We interviewed John Hughes. I did get to meet him once, which was, you know, one of the great moments of my life.
Yeah.
That's why I have a 16 Candles screenplay that is signed by him.
All of them.
Well, by Hughes and by Ringwald.
Yeah.
We interviewed Andrew McCarthy, who was kind of a prick. Did we interview James?
He's going to have to bleep out that word that you just
really?
Used.
You this can't
is
say
a,
that?
No, this is a clean podcast, and that is at best a PG-13 word.
Well, it's
can
the,
you say it on television now? Can
I
you say
you can,
that word?
Yeah.
I don't think you can.
Well, you're
going to have to bleep it out.
Fine. If I do bleep it, just so you know later, it's the thing that happens when your finger touches a pin. I can't remember if they gave us James Spader or not. Maybe they didn't. Maybe he wasn't, because he wasn't, you know, all that, you know, he was the tough turf guy at that point.
Did you get Harry Dean Stanton?
We did not get Harry Dean Stanton.
What?
That I would have remembered. We got Annie Potts, and we got John Cryer.
Whatever.
And one of my favorite John Cryer moments was, and at this point, yeah, he had done like that one movie with Demi Moore and was basically best known.
And he was like, I'm not Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, he was best known for he had taken over for Matthew Broderick in Biloxi Blues on Broadway or Brighton Beach Memoirs, one of those Neil Simon things. I, at the time, was a very dedicated Variety reader because I had managed to connive our school paper into buying a subscription and telling them it was very important for
always, always running a game. Always out to get for you.
And so one of the things I always loved about, and I guess they still do it to some extent, but in the 80s especially, you would see this a lot. Like, there would be lots of ads for movies that didn't exist yet or movies that they were trying to sell, you know?
Right.
Like, every year on the Cannes Film Festival, back when Canon Films was in business, they would take out this, like, 25-page full-color supplement in the middle of Variety and advertise all these movies that they were never going to make. It was great. I loved it. But one, I just remember seeing this ad for, it was John Cryer, who I didn't really know who he was yet, but the name stuck in my head, standing between, like, Lynn Redgrave and some dude who were like tied up and gagged, and he was standing between them smiling, and it was called something like Homefront, and it was just one of those sort of bits of useless information I filed in my head. So then we're in the press conference and we don't have much to ask John Cryer because none of us know who he is. So I go, tell us about this movie Homefront. Is it coming out anytime soon? And he gets this stricken look on his face and he goes, oh, is that coming out?
this movie got made.
This movie got made and released.
Yeah.
Under the title,
yes.
Morgan Stewart's Coming Home. You remember that one?
I seem to remember that title.
They retitled it to make it sound more like Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Or Roxy Carmichael's whatever.
No, Welcome Home, Roxy Carmichael. so I've still this day never seen this
Roxy
movie.
Roxy Carmichael's Boogaloo Shrimp. That was what it was called.
To this day, I've never seen Morgan Stewart's Coming Home, but I'll never forget the look on John Cryer's face. That was all I needed to know about that movie.
I saw him on the street one day, standing in front of an ATM, giving one of his kids a shoulder ride.
Uh-huh.
And my first impulse, which I did not follow, Never follow your first impulse. No, my first impulse was to yell "Ducky."
Yeah, because that never happened.
And then I thought, oh no, no, no. Yeah, my second impulse was to think
he's been through
enough.
You
would be the 700,000th person to do that to him.
And John Cryer has had a tough couple of years through no fault
of his own. No, he hasn't.
Well, he's been paid well for it.
He has not had a tough couple of years. He's had an annoying couple of years.
Okay, that's not the same. You're right. You're right. You're right. Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah.
We got to go to the premiere at the Chinese, which was very exciting because I'd never been here before, and the after party, which was shot for MTV. I remember seeing Michael J. Fox standing literally on a box to be interviewed by Fee Waybill, who was hosting it. Yeah. Little TV magic.
Can you imagine? Like, Michael J. Fox, like, that was the first thing that he had to swallow a big rock about, you know? The idea of, oh, yeah, you're going to have to stand on a box. Here and there and over here and in this scene and for this shot. Like, standing on a box was Michael J. Fox's career, and it was compensated, you know, very well.
I was going to say, like John Cryer, I'm sure it,
but
he was able
know,
to get
like,
through
after,
the annoyance
after,
of it.
Like, the first year, he's just like, yeah, I just have my own box. Like,
he probably had it in his entourage. It was probably the box handler.
His assistant,
you know,
would bring the box along. We'll just have the box ready. No, we don't need anybody.
Bring the box.
We don't need anybody to say, stop. Can we put him on a box?
If they come in, like, okay, where do you want the box? Box
that
on
was,
box.
Yeah. That, you know that. But you know, initially, early on, he was like, yeah.
But, you know, I always remember the year that he won
it. And then he got $1 million and he got over it.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember the year that he won an Emmy and he said, I feel 5 feet tall.
I remember
which
that.
Was,
I remember
which
that
was
too.
Genius. Yeah. You're Dave White of Movies.com and Slake Magazine.
Yes. If you are a magazine reader, perhaps. Perhaps. Sorry. We don't indulge in private jokes very often, but that was just one, and it's too long.
It would take too long to
explain. It's too long to explain, and it's not even all that funny. No. It just makes us laugh. Then the new issue of Slake is out right now, and I am in it.
Yes.
Telling a poignant story.
Someone's mother.
Somebody's
mother.
I didn't even
not
call
your title,
it that title.
I know.
At the reading a few weeks ago. Did I already tell this story on the show? About the
you
title?
Talked about how great you were, but you didn't talk about the title.
The
now.
Title change. They changed the title, and I didn't know they had changed the title until the issue came out. And the name of the story originally was one Ishti nursing home after another. That was the name of the story. And then I, without telling me, they changed the title to Somebody's Mother, which is better than my title, because, you know, I mean, you look at a magazine, it's full of stories and whatnot, and you're like, oh, this title has the word "ishti" in it and nursing home. Not reading that, yeah. I'll be too bummed out. But you know me, I'm vivacious and
well, and also the theme of the issue was dirt after
full
all.
Full of, yeah, full of snappy remarks. And so the story is not a bummer, really.
No.
Although Lori, my editor, was like, it made me cry. Oh. I was like, okay. I mean, I understand that's praise. But I get worried when if I'm writing a story about that, you know, situation, I don't want to bum people out. I don't want to make them cry. You know.
Well, you're not being mawkish, but I mean,
exactly.
I think this, you know, it's a story that could be moving.
So anyway, I'm in the new issue of that,
and we have a link to Amazon on the Linoleum Knife podcast.
And
page
Alonzo
on
will put up another one of those today.
Absolutely.
When we are. Although Slake asked me if we would link through their site for some reason.
Really?
They sent me an email asking, and I can't remember now
because
why.
If people buy it from Amazon through our link on our page,
we get a little kick.
We get a little kick
back. I know. But I think there's some reason that Slake, I'll go back and look at the email, but Slake wants us to do it through there.
All right. Well, we'll post both. Follow your conscience, listeners.
Well,
if they don't.
And remember that you're getting the show for free.
I would sooner support the magazine than our little kickback, because I would like the magazine to thrive.
To survive. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Why you gotta be so selfish? So greedy and like a Bain Capital executive.
I'm the king of Bain.
Yeah.
Why don't you introduce me for once?
You're Alonzo Duralde of TheRap.com, which is also distributed on the Reuters wire. Which means you get invited to things I don't. And you're also from the Internet Television Movie Review Program, What the Flick, which also co-stars the featured players Matt Atchity and Christy Lemire, and someday Ben Mankiewicz is going to come back.
He's ever back from Europe.
From effing around Europe.
If he doesn't go all Hemingway on us and actually comes home.
And occasionally Gray Drake, and I don't know who else.
I'm a featured player now, you know.
I know, that's what I said. You're the star, and they're your...
That's not
Gladys Knight.
No.
And you're... Well, and that's how I see the show. I see you as the boss.
That's very sweet. But
I see you as the boss, and the rest of them as your chorus.
No.
You tell them all I said that, too.
Yeah, because God knows they don't listen to this show. Unless they're on it.
And so,
maybe not even then.
What else do you do? Oh, you wrote a book, Christmas movie book?
Yeah.
Have yourself a movie little Christmas. I know it's May. But
we'll talk about that more later.
Shouldn't you be stocking up on that book right now for future Christmas gifts? Won't you be happy with yourself when in December you'll think, wow, I don't have to do any more shopping for friends. I've purchased a dozen copies of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, which I will now distribute to my friends, maybe even on December 1st, to give them 24 more days to use it in good health and happiness so that they can watch awesome Christmas movies all month. And enjoy the clever write-ups of each film and why they're in the book by Alonzo Duralde.
Yes.
That's what should happen. Go get it now. Go get that book now. Get a lot of them.
Beat the rush.
Yeah. All right. Movies. Battleship.
Battleship.
Apparently, you and I are the only people who... in the world, who saw Battleship, knew it was stupid, knew it was bad, and enjoyed ourselves anyway.
Well, I think some people actually liked it more than we did. But yeah, we're definitely in the minority of people who sort of acknowledged, yes, this is ridiculous, but hey, it's not boring. And frankly, at this point in the game, not boring carries a lot of weight with me.
I enjoyed all the... chicken burrito,
yes.
Stuff. I enjoyed all the Coke Zero stuff,
and the Subway.
I enjoyed the Subway stuff. I enjoyed the spinning. Go ahead, open it. Be all comedy couch. Open that thing. Yeah, I enjoyed the. I enjoyed the giant rotating death phantasm balls that the
buzzsaw wheels
those were
pretty rad.
Great. Those should have killed a lot more people and destroyed a lot more things.
Well, they seemed very aimed at like machinery and architecture.
They were, yeah, because if they found out you were a human, they weren't quite so interested in you.
Yeah, no. Because of a PG-13,
they wanted to destroy the machines, which of course means that they might not have even been particularly,
lethal.
Lethal to us as people, as long as we steered clear of all cars and buildings that they wanted to.
Right. Well, they also took that highway down, so presumably it killed the people in the cars that.
Well,
all
yeah,
fell.
But they weren't focusing on those people because they're dumb.
No,
they're lizard. They were lizard people.
They were going after the columns, holding up the freeway.
Yeah, and so they sort of had ambiguous intentions, the aliens, and there was no explanation as to why they wanted to kill the machines and.
That's true. A manifesto is never issued.
They hated architecture and machines
and helicopters.
And helicopters.
Yeah, yeah. We don't know if they were gonna colonize.
It's a mysterious
or
film, really
what
on that level. It's a movie that
it's
leaves you
hauntingly elliptical.
Yeah, it leaves you asking yourself a lot of questions when you really sort of soul soul excavating questions when you leave the theater. Like,
very Bressonian.
What of the, we'll get to that. We'll get to the Bressonian in this. You know, why these aliens? Why this destruction and not that destruction?
And why, as Christy pointed out later, why do the aliens have the weakness that they have when they live on a planet that is as far from their sun as we are from ours?
Yes. Well, they've always got sunglasses on and helmets and things, apparently. Obviously, they don't live on their planet unshielded.
Right. But that's ridiculous.
Look, nothing in this movie holds up to any sort of...
scrutiny.
Yeah, and... it's obviously it's a terrible movie, but at the same time, it
keeps moving forward.
It's so dumb. It keeps going and keeps doing dumb things that made me go, oh, ha, 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 that's dumb. Show me something else that is dumb. And it did. It kept showing me something else that was dumb. Mm-hmm. And it
ups the ante a lot.
I can appreciate that. Here's an interesting thing about that, though. And I don't think we need to discuss the film or its problems anymore. What I'm most interested in talking about regarding this movie is the response from people.
Uh-huh.
I've had actual angry responses from people this week. And I haven't even read the comments.
You mean from people you know?
People who are like, I can't believe you liked that movie. And I would always say, well, let's talk about what the word like means. Are you capable as a viewer of differentiating between a good movie and a bad movie that is still fun to watch? Because I think what happens in people's heads is that they get this idea that if I liked it, if I had a good time, then it was a good movie.
Right. No, that came up on, when I reviewed this for What the Flick this week, the first thing I said was, it's a movie that is entertaining without being any good.
Right.
And so there was this whole discussion of like, what? No, if it's entertaining, then it's good. And then other people
was this
like,
among
the commenters. And then
the commenters or the people on the show?
Oh, no. The people on the show got where I was coming from with this. They just clarified. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, the commenters on the show were like, no, if it's entertaining, it's good. And then other commenters were like, no, what about The Room? You know, and it went sort of back and forth. And it's like, yeah, there are different dichotomies at play here. And and this is a movie that is entertaining, but terrible. But it's still entertaining, you know, and I'm willing to make that differentiation because we see so many movies that are just terrible.
Right.
And just agony to sit through that, you know, it's worth pointing out. Yes, this movie is moronic and it doesn't make any sense. And it's, you know, clearly a shallow marketing cash grab that it's based on a board game. But I had a good time watching it.
And so was Clue. Clue was based on a board game.
Right, but as I point out in my rap review, Clue came with characters and a plot and locations, right. And this movie, this game comes with, you know, boats and pegs and a grid.
Yes.
But we get pegs and a grid, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, the bombs are pegs.
Yes.
One spoiler, nobody says, oh, you sunk my battleship.
I know, I was furious.
The closest they come
How
to,
dare they?
The closest they come to is one of the old veteran dudes says, they're not going to sink this battleship.
Right.
I'm like, well, why aren't they? Why can't someone sink the battleship so that someone else will say, oh, you sunk my battleship? Like,
or they could have thrown in
Taylor Kitsch should have said it.
Yes, or they could have thrown in some other line like, pretty sneaky, sis, or something.
That's not from that.
I know, but it just...
That's the wrong commercial.
It would have been a shout-out to acknowledge the whole... The commercial enterprise of this thing.
Wrong commercial.
I know. I'm aware of that. Yeah. But yeah, when they actually set the grid up and start, you know, like sending...
I know, it's so exciting.
I was like, oh my God, they're playing Battleship. I love this. They're playing Battleship with Rihanna.
It's a hit. I wish I could tell you what I saw on Rihanna's Twitter feed this week. But I'm going to have to tell you off the microphone when we're done. Okay. Remind me to tell you because...
Not fit for a clean podcast.
There's not even a way...
to talk around it.
There's not even a way to talk around it. But you should go to Brianna's Twitter feed. I don't know if it's a few days ago or now. I don't know how many. I don't know how long you'll have to scroll down to get it. But someone was mocking one of her outfits.
from like the premiere or something?
I think so. And she responded in a way that is both caustic, profane, and hilarious.
And, right.
And like, it makes you think that like maybe Rihanna is not an idiot. Like, if she can retort like this, then you think there might be a little more to Rihanna than previously imagined.
She's not terrible in this. Somebody that
she's not good, but she's not embarrassing.
But she's just you know, somebody that
she's just there.
Somebody who saw this before us was like that. It was the worst performance he'd ever seen
in human history. Yeah, and it's like who said that?
Christian of the Schmoes said that. And then I saw it. I was like,
oh, Christian,
come on. Not true. I mean, it's nothing special, but it's nothing special in the bad category either. Right. It's just like, you know, whatever, you know. she's not as good as albino Matt Damon, whoever that guy is.
Well, yeah, no.
Who apparently was on Friday Night Lights, so another Peter Berg veteran.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter Berg directed it. He did, you know, he did the Friday Night Lights movie and the TV show. He did The Kingdom and The Breakdown and a bunch of other stuff.
I forget what else.
Yeah, if anybody is a really terrible actress this week in this movie and in another one, it's Brooklyn Decker.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with Brooklyn Decker.
Well,
Brooklyn Decker.
Terrible is putting too fine a point on it.
She's really pretty.
She's really pretty. That's about it.
She's really, really pretty.
Really, really pretty.
Yeah. Like, she's got on a tank top and Battleship.
And again, that's about it.
She's wearing a tank top and Battleship the entire movie.
My favorite character.
You're looking at her tank top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My favorite character was Hamish Linklater as the techno nerd.
I just, every time he would come on screen, I'd be like, you were just in a Miranda July film.
Yeah, but he's also on The New Adventures of Old Christine.
I know, but I don't think.
He covers the waterfront.
I don't think of him as that. I think of him as the guy from the future.
Yes.
Which is a great movie that Alonso hated it, but it's fantastic.
And I assume that the gentleman with the prosthetic legs actually has prosthetic legs.
We don't know, do we? I mean, those could have been all digital.
I'm thinking they went Harold Russell and found somebody who, you know.
Yeah. So yeah. Battleship. The end of talking about Battleship.
And as long as we're talking about Brooklyn Decker, we might as well go...
End of Battleship.
End of Battleship. Which will probably not have a sequel since apparently...
To be Godardian about it.
Since apparently it's tanking in the U.S., even though it did really well in countries where they don't speak so much English.
No one's going to see it?
It's going to do about 25 or 30 this weekend, which is...
That's crazy.
Yeah, and it cost over 200. Yay. But they've already made over 200 overseas, so, you know.
How did that happen? You would think that people would just eat this right up.
It's got a cinema score of like C. People are not
really
having it. Yeah,
but people are idiots.
I know, but that's the thing. You know, if people were stupid in a consistent way, they would take the guesswork out of this whole business.
This was not the right kind of stupid for me.
Yes,
this has to be a whole other different kind of stupid.
I prefer my stupid movies based on toys to have robots that turn into cars.
Is it possible that this movie made too much sense?
It certainly doesn't, like...
Wait a minute. Wait. End of Battleship. We don't care anymore. We don't care anymore. We're done. We're moving on.
I don't know. I was going to say we're moving on.
You know why we're moving on? Because we don't have a lot of time.
All right.
What to expect when you're expecting?
Oh...
And that's what you can't expect when you're expecting, apparently.
Actually, among
ladies are gassy all the time. And so here's my review of this film. The comedy, I'm going to be real fast about this. The comedy is boring and bland.
And strained and tacky.
And it's the kind of thing, it's the kind of comedy that is for audiences who like their comedy to be just like that.
Mm-hmm. Like the people we saw it with.
Yeah. Who were...
Way too into it.
Really, really much too into it. Like gasping with excitement and oh no.
Not like, since Gigli have I been with an audience that was that engaged in a movie so terrible.
The woman behind us who was screeching laughing.
Oh man.
For the entire film. And I was like, I'm sorry. Is someone tickling you? Behind
us? Have you never seen a movie or television show before?
Like, if the train comes toward the screen, do you think it's going to come run over you?
The guy at the end of the Great Train Robbery shoots at the camera. Are you going to duck?
Yeah. Like, it was so insane to be around this preview audience. And the guy behind me who literally kept saying, oh, no, oh, no. Anytime anything looked like it might go wrong for somebody, he'd go, oh, no. And I was like, where are you? Because it was dark. I couldn't see.
Now, why didn't those people go see Battleship? Because they clearly would have had a great time.
They would have had a blast, yeah. And the only, here are the two parts of this film that could have been another movie.
Yeah.
Entirely. Anna Kendrick.
Yes, who's the best thing in it.
Was in her own film.
Yeah.
like she just saw the script.
Didn't read the other pages.
Yellow Sharpied her lines and pretended the rest of it was not happening. Because her storyline is dramatic.
Yeah.
And it involves problems.
Yes.
In her pregnancy. The other storyline that I found unexpectedly moving, once it dispensed with the idea that it was also going to be a little comedic, was the Jennifer Lopez, Rodrigo Santoro storyline, where real life problems beset them. You know, like she's a freelancer, and she gets shut out of work, and then
right at the time that they're adopting, because she's totally infertile.
Yeah, and they're going to try to buy a house, and the job loss is happening, and she's infertile, and you know, real things are happening to her in the film, and it's weird because, you know, she's not in it a ton, because nobody is in it a ton. It's kind of like the Valentine's Day
model. It is very Gary Marshall-y.
But her plot line, which ends finally in them adopting, this is, you know, barely giving away anything, ends finally in them adopting a child, which is another thing that most films about childbirth or having babies never approach. And if they do approach it, it's always with the, yeah, we tried adoption, but ew, you know. And so they adopt a child. They go to Africa, like Ethiopia, to get a kid. And when she gets the kid, she bursts into tears. And it feels so real when she cries. And you're caught off guard, because the movie's such garbage overall that when she expresses this emotion on screen that feels real, you're like, you're going to make me cry too, Jennifer Lopez. Knock it off. Also, it's Jennifer Lopez, who hasn't been in a good movie since Out of Sight in the 90s. And so that's even more surprising. And she's not in a good movie now, but there are always these moments with Jennifer Lopez in a film where I think, oh, wait, you are actually capable of more. I've seen you in a Steven Soderbergh movie where you were great in a really good movie. This means it's in you somewhere.
Somebody can bring it out of you.
Somebody can bring it out of you in some moments. You're actually affecting as an actress.
I have said this before,
yeah,
and I will say it again, and one day it will be available on DVD and people know that I'm not insane. The Jersey Girl director's cut. She's so good in it. And in the theatrical version, because everybody was so sick of Bennifer by the time that movie came out, they kill her off in the first 15 minutes. Whereas in Smith's original edit, she doesn't die for like 45 minutes.
Right.
And she gives a really moving and sweet and funny performance. And just really like charismatic, and you know, you love her. And so when she dies, it's a big deal, and you understand why the Affleck character is so bereft about it.
Right.
So yeah, she, every so often, she's Halle's actress, you know. You'll get a really good Jennifer Lopez performance, and this is one of them. Although, of course, Christy pointed out, she wore false eyelashes to go to the adoption agents to go pick up the baby in Ethiopia. And I said,
Well, she's Jennifer Lopez.
I said, she's Jennifer Lopez would, you know.
And how do you know they're false eyelashes? How do we know that she's just not, like, that gifted?
Maybe she took Latisse
or whatever. Maybe she takes Latisse. Who knows what she
Maybe does. She was lashier in that scene than in the rest of the movie. I don't know.
I wasn't paying attention to her lashes. Yeah.
Yeah, but you're right. But apart from those two elements of the film, bleh, garbage, stupid, stay away.
Yeah.
And there is a Bridesmaid's Curse. I'm just going to say it.
I don't know that there is.
evidence points towards one.
Evidence points towards Bridesmaids being an awesome movie with a large cast of people who need to continue working. And they will they will take roles in films that are not
okay,
good.
But this
movie has three Bridesmaids people in it.
And we're coming off another terrible movie that had four Bridesmaids people in it. So hopefully they'll all have... Who's left that we haven't gotten that? This is Ellie Kemper and...
Well, Kristen Wiig won't.
Kristen Wiig was in...
I know, but... If you go back and look at that terrible movie that she was in, she had an interesting role and comported herself well.
Oh, no, I'm not saying...
As an angry person.
I'm not saying these people don't do well in the movies. I think that Ben Falcone in What to Expect does what he can with this awful dog's breakfast of a script he's been given. But, you know, generally speaking, though, these people...
Sorry, my mic is all twisty up again.
These people are getting stuck in... you want the light to be on top.
Why do I want the light to be on top?
I don't know. It's just what Gray told me once.
Well, the light's on the side. It doesn't matter, does it? I mean, now the light's on top.
Fine.
There.
you know, so I'm not blaming the actors. It's not like they're not being good in another movie. They're just in a terrible movie, you know. Yeah. So I'm trying to think of who's left from the cast of Bridesmaids.
I don't know. Let's just... End.
Melissa McCarthy.
We're
still waiting for her follow-up, too.
End of What to Expect when you're expecting.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Jean-Luc. The Dictator. It's a mess. As you have pointed out, sometimes you just sort of count the number of times you laughed, and if it's more than 10, even if it's like, all right.
In an 85-minute movie, if I laugh 10 times, that's one laugh per 8 minutes. It's not quite enough, but it's... Almost enough.
I think I may have laughed more than
I
10
wanted,
times, but all here, I did, all my, I got out of this movie was
the very conventional film,
discreet
Sacha
ETE
Baron Cohen
laughs.
As the dictator of the despotic dictator of a fictional Middle Eastern country. And he, through a series of events that involve, you know, oil company machinations and
body doubles,
and you know. Revenge, blah, blah. He winds up in America, deposed and...
Beardless
and working in a vegan co-op with...
Anna Faris,
who's, you know, a parody of a lefty with hairy armpits and the whole, you know, that sort of thing going on. I expect so much more from Sacha Baron Cohen. I expect Borat-level... Like incendiary kind of stuff.
This movie has one
When you make your first splash in the United States with the cinematic equivalent of like a firestorm, you can't
dial it back.
You can't dial it back. Yeah, and this was a very first of all, it wasn't him as a character dropped down into the real world like Borat or Bruno.
No, it's a scripted film.
It was a scripted, you know, film with you know, characters and all fictional and in a very, very, very conventional structure and a very conventional approach to Adam Sandler-ish sort of comedy, honestly. Until the final 5 minutes when he suddenly turns it into Borat again. Which,
yeah, there's a speech at the end that was clearly, I think, the whole reason of making the movie.
Yeah.
And it's a great piece of satire, and on its own...
It's a great 30 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's this great minute that you have to sit through another 79 to get to.
Yeah. And that's it.
I laughed because a lot of the stuff is funny, but it's not very well structured. It's not as biting as it could have been.
It's
not biting at all,
it's
really.
It's not biting. It's just sort of... I mean, I laughed enough. I did laugh. Like, I'm an easy... Well, we've discussed this. I am an easy laugh, Your Highness. I will laugh at a lot of things. But I'm chuckling. It's empty.
They're not belly laughs.
They're not anything. Yeah, and so
you pointed out something in your review that I hadn't thought about, which is basically
it's very middling.
What this movie is not is Four Lions.
Right.
And that is a movie that is that takes a really daring stance on making jokes about terrorism.
So daring's not the word for Four Lions. Daring is like where Four Lions starts,
yeah,
and pushes you over a cliff by the time it's over.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want your sense of humor tested?
Yeah.
Watch Four Lions. That movie is brutal and brilliant.
Yeah. And very, very funny.
But
I'll post a link.
Yeah. This is just meh. At least it's done in 80 minutes.
Yes. It is blissfully short.
And I would like, you know, and who knows, maybe the studio was like, okay, you have to cut this, you have to cut this, you have to cut this, you have to cut this. Maybe that was what happened.
I don't think so.
We don't know. We don't know.
I'm guessing not.
I don't know how powerful he is.
I remember that, like, after Borat, there was that crazy bidding war over Bruno.
Right.
Which
no one went to see.
Yeah, which I'm sure Universal is probably not happy to have won.
Nobody saw Bruno.
But I think that he, I bet you that he has say.
Maybe.
Just a hunch.
Possibly.
Especially with how much he's been out promoting it and stuff.
Right.
But who knows? You're right. We don't know. Okay. End the Dictator. Anything else this week?
You seen anything else this
week? You saw Hysteria.
I did, and I'm not really ready to talk about it yet because it opened Friday, but my review on the site is going to go up late, like tomorrow, and I haven't even finished writing it yet. Because I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this. It's not good.
Really? I heard it was funny.
It's such a complicated movie about a subject that deserved less silly treatment.
Hmm.
Even if they wanted to make it a comedy, which I'm not opposed to, it deserved a less of a, you know, kind of approach, and that's exactly what it got.
You would prefer more of a...
I always prefer that. Give me the yakety sax anytime over, you know, the beepity-beepity-beepity kind of, you know, whimsy stuff. I saw a Russian film this week called Elena.
Yeah.
By a director whose name I cannot pronounce because it's full of hard consonants all jammed right up against each other.
Right.
But he is also the director of a movie that I thought was brilliant from, and I've said the word brilliant now twice to describe films, and I'm going to stop.
Please.
A terrific movie called The Return.
Mm-hmm.
Devastating psychological thriller about a father and his two sons off on a camping trip in the middle of, like, nowhere. This is another psychological thriller. And I guess thriller's the wrong word. Psychological drama. Very tense, almost Hitchcockian sort of movie about a Russian woman who's late middle age, and she is a former nurse. Always been very sort of working class. And late in life, she marries a rich guy who's a little even more older than she is. Like, she might be in her late 50s, and he's at least in his late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
He's very cold, but he takes very good care of her. She's a very sort of, you know, almost obedient kind of housewife. He'll be like, bring me my blah, 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 and she'll go get it, you know.
My Haas and Pfeffer.
She wakes him in the morning and she's like, I've prepared you breakfast. You know, it's like that kind of, right, you know, housewife sort of situation. But they live in a sweet house. Like, you're watching this movie and you're like, I'd move to Russia to live in that house. That's a nice, nice house. And here's what you find out about him. He's rich, obviously. And he has an estranged relationship with his adult daughter, who's not nice. She's just mean and, you know, unpleasant. And she and the father have, like, bitter, you know, discussions with each other. And she's very sort of like, me, 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 me. Like, she's sarcastic about everything. And she, Elena, has a...
Wait, is Elena the wife or the daughter?
Elena is the wife.
Okay.
Yeah. She, Elena, has a chronically unemployed son who sits around and drinks beer and eats peanuts all day.
In their house?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, in his own crappy apartment with his wife, who also seems to be unemployed, and their sullen, do-nothing teenage son who does nothing but play video games and can't even be bothered to have tea with grandma when she comes to visit, and their accidental toddler. Elena gives them her pension each month to live on, while she herself is being taken care of by the rich husband. And then the rich husband has a heart attack that is nearly fatal. And the result of this heart attack is a reconciliation of sorts with the estranged daughter.
I see where this is going.
And then he announces to Elena, I'm going to prepare a will. And I'm going to leave everything to my daughter. And that's where the movie, about 20 minutes in, that's the what's going on in the movie. And then the action starts. And I as in the review I wrote, I compared it as the cold, bitter Russian flip side to Olivier Assayas's Summer Hours. Where that movie was about an old money family dealing with what to do with the
treasures
museum,
the
museum quality level furniture and art left behind by the passing of the matriarch.
Right.
And it's about how their, you know, emotional distance and entropy and their estrangement and the effects of globalism and the way that they're scattered all across the world as siblings have.
This is a movie that came out before we started doing this show. Yeah. I cannot recommend it enough.
People.
Summer Hours.
It's called Summer Hours.
Great movie.
There's a Criterion Collection DVD.
Yes, there is.
Of it. And it's worthy of that. It's such a great movie. And if you ever get the chance to watch it with Alonzo Durrell, Dave, you will enjoy the sight of him crying like a baby.
Which I can't believe you're going there.
Always entertaining.
And I was devastated by that film.
No, I know.
For reasons that have very little to do with the film. Even. It pressed one of my buttons.
I know.
And now you're telling everybody, and you're an awful person.
It's just fun to watch you cry in movies. Anyway.
You didn't even see me cry. I had to leave the theater. I was that upset.
Yeah. So, I've actually made you angry. Do we need to cut? Do we need to cut this part?
Oh no, no, it's staying in, so that everyone can know that you're awful.
So anyway, this is the kind of inheritance movie where you worry about who will get out alive by the end of it.
And now, what's going to happen to the Vases?
And then the people who do get out alive, you actually think to yourself, oh, God, you just screwed yourself even weirder. You know, like, it's really cool.
There are no winners here, basically.
It may have opened in New York only, I think, this weekend. And it'll be opening in Los Angeles soon. And then it's going to be, it's a Russian movie. So it's going to slowly go to other big cities and then DVD. And I don't think it's on demand yet either. So
Be on the lookout.
Put it in your
Netflix.
File it away in your mind, like put it on your list or whatever. But it's great.
Paul Tram, by the way, of Secretly Timid, did he show you his list?
No.
He has this list in his iPhone. And every time we talk about a movie, new movie, old movie, whatever, it goes on the list.
E-L-E-N-A, so, Elena.
Put that on your list, Paul Tram.
And then I also saw Bresson's The Devil Probably. The Devil, probably. Which is comes from Dostoevsky.
Ah.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, before this retrospective at the Arrow of Bresson movies, I had seen O Hussard Baltasar and I had seen Diary of a Country Priest. I had only seen two of his 13 films. And now that I've seen more, and I'm going to go see more of them tonight, here's what I can say, which is not a great revelation based on what other people have said about this guy, but the greatest filmmaker that ever lived, honestly. And maybe it's just because I'm high on him right now, but maybe it's because I've been seeing like extra special garbage from my job.
What, lately. Better than what to expect when you're expecting?
Then it's like the the other planet sort of quality of the perfection of these movies is mind blowing. You know, the it's and this is a film that when it was released in 1977, was banned in France, which they don't ban.
That takes a lot.
They don't ban anything.
You got to really try.
It was not banned specifically. It was banned for people under 18. You weren't allowed to see it if you were under 18 because they decided that it was an incitement to suicide.
Wow.
Yeah. And so for years, it was like, if you are under 18, you cannot see this film in France. It only played in America like a little bit. Like it didn't even get over here. But it's a movie about a young, a teenage guy, maybe 18, 19 years old, who decides that he's going to kill himself. And the film lays out his reasons why he's planning to do these things. And it's all incredibly sort of like reasoned and rational and it involves...
It doesn't counter with Emily's reasons why not?
No. It involves... It involves him... winding up in a variety of, you know, locations. Like there's a scene in a church where it's him and these other young people who all, you know, it's 1977. So it's this post-hippie, post-1968 kind of stuff in France where
the moi generation.
The young people walk around like with their hair in their face, with the look on their, you know, the expression of, and what do you got for me? You know, that sort of like stare in at nothing,
right?
Kind of bored expression.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they're all sitting in a church and they're just discussing the emptiness of Catholicism. And it's just a random sort of volleyball game of like strangers throwing out, you know, statements. Things like the future of Christianity will not involve religion. And then someone else will say something to the priest like, have you not done irreparable harm to blah, blah, blah? Like, it's just this very sort of...
Does the priest make any counter arguments here? Or is he just
tries. You know, there's an amazing, amazing scene on a bus where the title comes from. And I've got the text of it right here. He's on a bus, and again, he starts talking about, you know, why everything sucks. And everyone on the bus begins discussing these things too. And so...
France.
Yeah. He says, you know, the only real problem is that people don't see everything clearly. And someone else says, and then he says to the guy he's riding on the bus with, governments are short-sighted. And then someone else says, it's not the governments to blame. He says, it's the masses who determine events, obscure forces, whose laws are unfathomable. And a woman says, yes, something is driving us against our will. And somebody else says, yes, you must go along with it. And then someone else says, so who is it that makes a mockery of humanity? Who's leading us by the nose? And the other guy says, the devil, probably. And then the bus is involved in a car accident. It crashes, and the bus... And the bus driver gets off. But here's the thing about the scene.
Frida Kahlo is paralyzed.
The scene is so amazing because Rassan cuts away to things that other directors wouldn't cut away to, like people putting money in the till and someone pushing the button to get off and feet walking into the bus. And so he cuts away to other stuff, but it's this accumulation of chatter of people and bus noise and, you know, click, 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 and ching, 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 right. You know, like, and suddenly it becomes this tense thing and it's bewildering as to why strangers are suddenly having a conversation about free will and government failure and, you know, the efficacy of anything to save you, and then the bus crashes and the bus driver leaves. Like, he's not even going to drive anymore. He runs off and the cars start honking their horns. And it builds to a climax of, yeah, no one's driving the bus anymore. You're all stuck. You're stuck on this bus, and there's no one who's going to take you anywhere.
Sounds like Battleship.
Yeah. He goes to his psychiatrist.
Okay, stop.
No, I have to keep telling you. He goes to his psychiatrist. And
let people see this movie and discover it on their own. Don't give away all the stuff.
I just have to. Okay, I won't tell you anymore.
Let it go. Let it go.
I won't tell you anymore. But, like, it is brutal. It's so. It's not a film of despair. Ultimately, his movies are about
grace.
About they are spiritual films. And I don't know where he went with religion in his life or what he thought about religion in his life, but you can tell that it just consumed him.
Said he was very Catholic, right?
Well, initially, early on at least. I don't know his biography well enough.
Gotcha.
I got to get that big new book. There's a giant new book. Oh. The thing weighs 5 pounds. I picked it up. They had stacks of it at the Arrow.
Ah.
It's like this $45 book. Mm-hmm. But it weighs like a bag of sugar. It's like so heavy. And it's full of essays about him. And I must read every single one of them.
All right, fine.
Yeah.
We do need to... We have emails. We have emails from last week and this week to share.
Here's one. Do you think Marvel should get damage control into production due to the record-breaking numbers of the Avengers? After the superheroes defeat their foes and leave the cities in ruins, what happens to the city's infrastructure? The topic was touched upon a bit in the end of the Avengers, but I think a full movie, which would be a comedy, with cameos from the Marvel Universe could work. Any thoughts? That sounds like a good idea to me.
Get out of my brain. Because I have always been a huge damage control fan. Damage Control, for those of you who don't know, it's a short. Marvel has done it a few times as a mini series, like 6 issues, and the basic premise is they are a company, and what they do is put the skyscrapers back up after the Avengers or the Fantastic Four or whoever have had this giant fight with a supervillain in Midtown and left the subway broken and the streets ripped up. I've always thought that you could either get a really funny movie or a sitcom out of Damage Control where the superheroes would only show up at the very beginning to be like, could you guys take care of this? Thanks. We got to go. And then they go in and do the stuff. I think my favorite stuff in comics has always been sort of when the mundane sneaks into the world of, the universe of superheroes of the intergalactic. So, yeah. I mean, like there's a great one where they do some job for Dr. Doom. I guess they have to fix something in Latveria, and then he doesn't pay the bill, and so they have to sick their accountant on him.
Right.
And they put him on the cover holding like an overpass due notice that says, "Doom, you'll pay for this." And then the big Marvel, dramatic headline under it was, "When Doom defaults." So, yeah, who asked us about Damage Control?
Reese.
So, yes, Reese,
yeah, I don't know.
Good call. I totally support a Damage Control movie.
Yeah. Are there other... I can't find any other emails.
There were two from last week that I sent you, and there's two that I just sent you.
Oh, there's two you just sent me. Okay, hang on. Yeah. Hang on. I can't find the other one from last week.
The other one from last week, I forget who wrote it, but was basically thanking us for playing the Dream Academy instrumental from Ferris Bueller's at the beginning of the show a couple weeks ago.
Okay, here's one. God bless you, David Alonso. But that's not a... I mean, this isn't a question. He's just telling us how great we are.
Well, it's still an email.
Thank you for talking about Ghost World, basically, is the crux of this. And he says it's one of his top 5 films. And he's from England, so he spells favorite FAVOURITE, yes. Which I am a big fan of. Extra letters. I've always
but when Americans
that.
Do it, it's pretentious.
I don't know. I'm not saying that I'm going to start doing it. Not part of my...
No, I'm just saying, I like when Americans online do it. I don't like it. I appreciated his very British use of the contraction shan't.
Yes.
That was James.
He's got top 5 films, but he doesn't want to tell us what they are because he thinks we're going to judge him. I wouldn't judge him. I would say if I liked it or not, but I wouldn't tell him he was a dummy. Unless he was a total dummy. Send us your list, man. Here's what we'll do. You send us your list, and we will tell you on the air here if you're a total dummy. Wouldn't that be great for you? Won't you? Won't you?
Who could turn that down?
He likes Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. So do I.
Nice choice.
So yes. I don't think we'll have a problem.
No.
With this. And then the other one is oh, 5-year engagement. Having read Dave's memoir, Exile in Guyville, I noticed some interesting parallels between the plot of the 5-year engagement and the situation detailed in the book, which is a book about you dragging me off from Texas to Los Angeles.
Yes.
And me not having a good time.
Until you did.
Until I got a book deal based on not having a good time.
Then suddenly it was great.
Then suddenly Los Angeles was wonderful. I also have read both your reviews of the film. Dave finds it middling, whereas Alonzo thinks it is quite good, but characteristically overlong. It is also clear that Dave does not really sympathize with these characters, whereas Alonzo seems to find them relatable. Dave, do you think your lack of sympathy for the characters stems from your own personal sacrifice? And there was a lot of it. I just added that to the list.
Please, I fixed your life.
In moving from your beloved Dallas to Los Angeles, which you required the 5 stages of grief eventually to accept. And Alonzo, do you think that you're being on the Emily Blunt side of the equation, selfish, influenced your opinion of the movie? Your pal, Timmy in Connecticut.
Thank you, Timmy.
In Connecticut. I don't know if that's
an interesting theory.
It's an interesting question. I'm going to have to think about it. Here's my thing.
I was not selfish. I told you years ahead of time that it was going to happen, and that if you didn't want to go with me,
that's true.
You wanted to go.
I will say this. First of all, I think I might have to reevaluate that movie. I might need to see it again, and I'm willing to say that I could be wrong. I've read some really, really good reviews of the film that make it sound way more important than I was getting it at the time, and I know that sounds weird to say important when you're talking about a movie like The 5-Year Engagement, but I think comedies can be real, you know, it can be about real things and explore them in a way that most comedies don't, and that we just sort of on first, you know, viewing are not ready to
absorb.
And that happens even to people, you know, who do it for a living. And so I'm willing to watch that movie again in the future, not right now. First point, I could be wrong about this movie. Second point, I don't know that I didn't think anything about me when I was thinking about these characters. Although it might be some intrinsic thing in my head where...
Yeah, I wasn't consciously thinking about our situation in relation to their situation.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
But yeah, who knows what goes on in the deep recesses of our subconscious. But
here's the thing. He resents her in the film.
True.
I never resented you for bringing me here. I always knew it was my problem. Mm-hmm. Like, I always knew that me hating it here was the result of me hating all kinds of change in my life.
Being a big baby.
I hate being uprooted. I was joking with somebody earlier this week, and I can't remember now who it was or what the context was, but it was Tram, and he said something about I was walking behind you and Tom too far away, and you guys got in the line faster than I did, and I had to like weave my way through all these people and be like, excuse me, pardon me, I'm up with these guys, and he goes, and Tram looked at me, and I go, look, I'm just really slow. I'm a tortoise. I don't move.
You don't spring into action
quickly. Yeah, and that's where that happened. Yeah, and I say that in the book too. In fact, I describe myself as a tortoise. I just do things slowly. I'm not, you know.
So what does that have to do? Oh, you mean you adjust slowly?
And I adjust. I adjust slowly. I accept things slowly. Gotcha. I'm not, you know. Okay, I'm a big baby. Whatever. I would like to take this opportunity to officially apologize to you for mocking you about crying at summer hours. And we will discuss the reason for that apology off the air, because I wasn't thinking of something when I said it, mm-hmm. something that I should have been thinking about, mm-hmm. because it had not yet entered my brain. See what I mean? Slow. And so Yes. If I'm going to mock you on the air and make you angry, you have a reason to be angry. And so I take this opportunity to apologize to my co-host and life partner, Alonzo Duralde, for crying during summer hours. He had a good reason.
Thank you.
I know when I'm wrong. You got to go. You got to get in the shower. Okay, just, you got to get dressed. Relax. You have things you have to go do. There's no DVD recommendations.
Yes, we're doing DVD recommendations.
I'm not.
We're talking about Ben and Arthur.
All right, go.
Ben and Arthur is like The Room for gay people. It is.
Well, I like The Room and I'm gay.
But it's.
This is a gay
version. It is about gay people then.
I don't even think we should sully the quality of The Room.
True. It does make The Room spent a little money. And
there's a level of competency going on in The Room.
Yeah.
That is not on display here.
No.
In Ben and Arthur.
Indeed not. Sam Moravich is no Tommy Wiseau. Try as he might.
No. Tommy Wiseau hangs out at our post office, by the way.
Yeah, you keep texting me every time you see him. Yeah, Ben and Arthur is this gay indie about a couple who want to get married, but they keep changing the law in Hawaii, and then Ben's evangelical brother, who is clearly a gay himself, keeps trying to get him to renounce his ways and finally tries to kill them, and it's loony pants, this movie.
Made for about 35 cents.
Yeah. And
in crappy apartments that exist
in the valley.
That exist here in Los Angeles, either in the valley or on this side. Who knows what side of the hill they were on when they shot these movies, when they shot this movie. But like the kind of apartments that make you just depressed looking at them. You know, just bare bones. Not everything's a mess.
White walls with awful things hanging
like a
on
mattress
them, a
up against
crap
the
on the
wall.
Floor, and a futon. Yeah, I think the whole thing actually might be on YouTube, so you can look for it there. I'll put a link.
Oh, I hope
to,
it is because that will save them the purchase or rental.
But it's oh man, it is. If you think you've seen all the bad movies out there, you got to see this one.
This one's unbearable. It was bearable because we saw it in a room full of people, like 20 people,
cracking wise,
all yelling at it. But I'll tell you, even the experience of sitting there and yelling at it, it's a very fish in a barrel kind of thing.
Kind of.
Like, there's no way you could watch it in any other context. This isn't a movie where, like, anyone would look at it and say, yeah, I see their point. Like, there's no...
It can only be mocked.
Right. It can only be pitied and mocked and then ultimately looked at in the context of, is the filmmaker completely with us?
Right.
In the real world, you know. Because unlike The Room, which has an element of mystery to it as to who is this intriguing Tommy Wiseau character,
where did he get the money?
You can sort of figure out what's going on with the guy who made Ben and Arthur. Like, it's all there on the screen, and it doesn't look good. It looks sad and weird.
Yeah.
It's the kind of film that makes you feel bad for the people involved. Not, you don't want to laugh at them too. Like, you would never want to laugh in their face or whatever. But
yeah, if they were in the room, you would just sort of. If they were in the
you'd
screening
be like,
room with
hi,
you,
good to meet
you.
You
would sort
you
of
walk
you would
away,
get
you know?
Guiltily quiet. Yeah. Whereas Tommy Wiseau has at least sort of embraced the fact that people are laughing at his movie, but he's making money out of it, so he's perfectly fine with that. I don't know that this guy would ever have the sense of humor to be okay with
having
that.
Said all these things, you really need to watch this movie because it is out of control. Like, the plot involves taking Alaska Airlines to Vermont to get gay married in a place where there is no gay marriage quite yet.
Vermont where they have palm trees.
We're in a Vermont where there are palm trees, and then we're flying home from Vermont in a FedEx plane, and it involves Catholic murder plots, incest weirdness,
magic potions, several really fake guns,
yeah, impromptu murders for no real reason. It's cuckoo bananas.
It needs to be in your life.
Yeah. At least for a moment.
Yeah, for the 80 or so minutes of its running time.
If not forever.
As always, we thank you so much for listening. And and this Wednesday, by the way, if you were in Los Angeles, May 23rd, Downtown 30, the Outfest series continues with Johnny Guitar, and it's a really fun movie. Nicholas Ray, crazy Western with Joan Crawford and Sterling Hayden and Mercedes McCambridge and Ernest Borgnine, and it is a very trippy, crazy movie, and it's not currently available on DVD, so it's a rare chance to get to see it on the big screen. Want to thank our friends out there in the podcast universe, the Popcorn Mafia, the Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Blowhard, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Showbiz Sandbox, Secretly Timid, Throwing Shade, which gave us a nice shout-out this week, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, and Film Spotting SVU, hosted by my friends Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore. If you have not already... And
B-Movie Podcast.
Oh, and the... Good heavens. I need to add that to my list. The B-Movie Podcast with Bibbs and Whitney. No, no, they're awesome. If you've not already gone to iTunes and to leave us a positive review, if you're a fan of the show, please do. Share this show, post it on your walls and your Twitters and wherever it is you do things. Check into us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, at LinoleumCast. Like our Facebook page for the Linoleum Knife Podcast. I'm not going to be here next week because I'm going to be on, I'm going to be in Seattle doing...
But I'm going to be here with a special guest.
Yes, doing the short film jury at the Seattle International Film Festival, which I'm very excited about.
A special guest who knows how to operate all the equipment.
That, for a change, I'm sure that'll be nice. Yeah. And then the week after that, Dave's not going to be here, and I will have a special guest who is not 100% confirmed yet, but...
Get ready, everything you know is about to change.
So, yes, the next couple of shows are going to be, you know, footloose and fancy free. And then on the second week of June, we're back in action and
together again, reunited
for the first time. All right. Anyway, we thank you for listening and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.